Thank you. Okay, our next speaker is Professor Bob Edmonds from the School of Forestry, and he's going to talk to us about effects of forest harvesting and riparian buffers on headwater stream temperatures.
Okay, thanks. So so my co-authors, Dan Vogt, is a professor in the School of Forest Resources, and two previous students, Jessica Taylor and Garrett Lyles, and then Richard Bigley, who's here in the audience from the Washington DNR. So headwater streams are important on the landscape. They're small in size, but they can be as much as 80% of the total stream length. They have a high density on the landscape in steep terrain. They have high biodiversity for invertebrates, amphibians, and fish. They're very sensitive to landscape changes like forest harvesting. And there's great concern about headwater stream temperature and sediments as a result of harvesting that impact biota. And then, of course, what happens downstream in terms of accumulative effects. So there's a lot of interest in headwater streams. And this particular study that I'll talk to you about today was to look at the effect of clear-cut harvesting and riparian buffers on headwater stream temperatures in the July and August period during the hottest time of the year in lowland Douglas fir forest in western Washington. The second objective was to determine how long stream temperatures and headwater streams take to recover after clear-cut harvesting, and to determine management implications with respect to harvesting and stream temperatures. So those were the three. Now, people have studied headwater stream temperatures for a while here, and there's studies from California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. But there's pretty variable results in terms of the effects of harvesting. So summer maximum stream temperatures in clear cuts can be cooler or as much as 11 degrees higher Celsius compared to uncut forests. So there's a huge range there. The summer minimum temperatures are less sensitive to harvesting than the summer maximum temperatures. And if you do put riparian buffers on some of the small streams, you can reduce elevated temperatures by as much as a half. However, recovery can actually be quite long in terms of how long it takes to get back to the uncut forest temperatures, and as long as 15 years in some cases. So there's a lot of variation as you go from California up to British Columbia in terms of responsive stream temperatures. Well, one of the major interests in this whole business with temperature is that cold water species like salmon are very sensitive to temperature changes. And as Jessica mentioned, some fish even have lower temperatures like the 13 degrees in the Cedar River watershed there. So invertebrates and salamanders are also very sensitive to temperature changes. And of course, there's a huge variety of life that we have in some of these headwater streams. Even if they don't have fish in them, they certainly do have salamanders and invertebrates. So the sensitivity of fish and amphibians to temperatures, people have come up with some indexes like the Washington Department of Ecology criteria, where they have a seven-day average maximum temperature in excess of 16 degrees Celsius. That's something that you would monitor for to see if you're having any issues to do with salmon. Salamanders are also sensitive. Bruce Berry, who's down at Oregon State University, came up with this idea of a critical thermal maxima for northwest salamander. He did one for the southern torrent salamander where he acclimatized salamanders. This is done in the lab. He acclimatized salamanders at 10 degrees Celsius in the lab and then stuck them in warm water and see whether they turned upside down and had a problem. He didn't kill them. No salamanders were killed during the study. But they were disoriented. I think that was the word. So 26 and 27 degrees are something relatively high, but still, if it's 11 degrees higher than the uncut forest, it could potentially get to that point. Well, many factors affect stream temperatures: air temperature, the morphology of the stream, groundwater entering a stream, riparian basin vegetation condition, harvesting, shade aspect, whether you have wind throw and the sediments that would get into the stream that could affect the stream bottom, and stream wood. So it's not exactly an easy thing to figure out what will happen when you harvest the forest. Here's a diagram that sort of says the same thing, that water comes in one end of a stream and out the other, the reach that you're looking at there, and the energy balance of the stream is important with respect to the vegetation that's around it, how much radiation gets reflected, how much actually reaches the water. You've got hyperreic exchange, groundwater inflow, tributary flows, and a variety of factors are acting all at once. And then the other thing is that depending on where you measure the temperature is important too. So, for example, here, oops, get this to work here. There we go. If you look at the top line, this is at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and this is a forested area in British Columbia, and then the stream flows out of the forest into a clear cut and then back into the forest on the other side, and you notice that it's quite variable depending on where you measure it. So there's this lateral change in stream temperature as you move along the stream. And it's more sensitive in the afternoon hours when it's warmer. So that's something you have to take into account. You know, where do you measure the temperature? So in Washington, we have this, the Forest Practices Stream Classification that DNR has put out, and basically four types. So the shoreline type S, type F is fish-bearing streams, and then two types of non-fish-bearing streams, which are either non-perennial, NP, or NS, non-fish seasonal, or non-fish perennial. So these are the headwater streams, the last two there. Now, we've put a lot of work into trying to figure out how to protect the larger streams in terms of riparian buffers, and these type F streams that have fish have riparian protection, and we have devised this idea of having a core zone around the stream where you do no harvesting, and then an inner zone and an outer zone where you're allowed to do some harvesting as long as you don't impact the core zone in here. And these zones vary. The size is typically a 50-foot no-harvest buffer around the stream itself. But the inner and outer zones can vary, in this case, 10 to 100 feet in the inner zone and 22 to 67 feet. And the idea is to try to keep a certain number of trees per acre on the site. And the idea also is then you will reach some desired future condition, but allow some harvesting, of course, on the landscape. But this is designed, of course, to protect stream temperatures and also the fish that are in there. But we, in terms of headwater streams, have basically sort of discontinue that protection as you go further up into the watershed. So there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out how can you still harvest this area but still have protection so that you don't impact the temperatures and affect what's going on down lower in the watershed where the fish-bearing streams are. So there is a 10-meter equipment restriction zone, but if you have very wide buffer strips between here, you basically make timber harvesting very difficult. And there's a lot of timber harvesting that goes on in these upper parts of the watershed. So the idea is to try to see if you can protect these sensitive sites like seeps and springs, alluvial fans, unstable slope areas. But the question is, do you need to have some form of buffer around these streams to protect them? Is it just enough to protect the sensitive areas as you go upslope? Well, there's a lot of these areas that look like this in western Washington and Oregon and British Columbia. These are so basically below the snow zone, mostly dominated by Douglas fir, relatively high productivity forest, and, of course, lots of harvesting actually occurs in this area. So these forest practices rules are the default for non-federal landowners. DNR actually exceeds the forest practices rules, and they actually have more headwater stream protection than most of the landowners in this particular zone. And they've added stream protection alternatives and looking at smaller streams in terms of protection. And this is largely what I'm going to talk about here. So the study site is actually on a DNR property in Waddell Creek watershed, which is in the Capitol Forest southwest of Olympia. And it's a retrospective analysis, in other words, a chronosequence, looking at timber harvest, certain time periods after the harvest. So we went to stands that had already been harvested and didn't actually monitor the temperatures beforehand. I'll talk to problems about that in a minute. So this is the Waddell Creek watershed, which is just south of east of Olympia. These are the small watersheds. They're I've given these names here. I'll tell you more about them in a minute. And then we also looked at the Waddell Creek tributary, which is the large stream that flows out to the south here. So the next slide here shows the characteristics of the study streams, which are typically only 1.5 meters or less in size, so they're not big streams. And we had three unharvested streams that ranged in age from 60 to 89, three that were clear-cut 7 years ago, three that were clear-cut 14 to 17 years ago, and then some buffered streams that were sort of equivalent to those, 5 to 6 years, and then one that we actually did monitor for a year before it was cut. So we do have a little bit of pre-history on this one. Those are the names of the streams that were on the map there. They're typically in a relatively low elevation. They're steep. They have different aspects. And relatively small in size. So the biggest one's about 19 hectares or 20 hectares or so. And the Waddell Creek is a third-order stream. It's about 1,960 so hectares in size. So those are the streams that were studied. There were weirs put on, small weirs put on each of these as part of a study to look at nutrient losses. But we also looked at hydrology. So this water level sensor was placed in this plastic tube here. And it not only has a pressure transducer here, but it also has a temperature sensor at the bottom. So we looked at the temperatures here at these weirs. So I'll just show you what these stands look like. Here's the 7-year-old stand after clear cutting. Notice it has a fair amount of vegetation over the stream, which implies shading. And there's quite a lot of wood, small pieces of wood, as a result of harvesting. The trees are about 3 meters high. So there are three of those, three of these that are 14 to 17 years old. And trees are taller, they're 12 meters. Again, there's some shade over the streams. And that's another example of a weir that's there. And here are the uncut 60 to 89-year-old stands. These were resulted naturally after harvesting of the old growth that was there. So here's the little weir, small stream. Obviously, the trees are tall, 35 meters or so. And the stand is actually a little bit more open in this particular case because it's starting to break up when there are actually gaps in the forest. So here's the stream here, some wood that's over the stream. So typical conditions for that stand. And then we had these 5 to 6 year old buffered ones. This one has sort of partial buffering, so it doesn't have any buffers up in here. So this is like a variable buffer, as you could call. So it's not a continuous buffer. And then Waddell Creek, which is the big stream, is about 5 meters wide or so at the point where we measured it. So all of the other small streams are above it, so we were able to sort of look at the effects downstream on Waddell Creek. And this does have a buffered area beside it, largely with red alder, as you can see. So what happened in terms of the temperatures? This is over 2004 to 2006 period, so July and August temperatures. This is unharvested, this is 7 years after clear cutting, 14 to 17, and then the buffered 5 to 6 year old ones. And this is the maximum temperature that was recorded. So it's 15.2, and it's a little cooler, you see, in the 7-year-old clear cut, about the same in the 14 to 17-year-old, and actually a little bit warmer. But none of them, in the buffered one, but none of them are significantly different. So variation, tell you there's no significant difference there. This is the range from maximum to minimum. Not much difference there either, around 3 to 4 degrees, somewhere in there. And then the average daily maximum during the July to August period is obviously lower than the actual maximum temperature, but similar trend. So 13 degrees in the unharvested, about 12.4, a little cooler in the 7-year-old, similar in the 14 to 17, and a little bit warmer there in the buffered one. And then not much difference also in the minimum temperature. So this is in January 2005 to 2007. Pretty much the same. No significant difference. That's a little bit warmer in that 14 to 17-year-old one. So not much difference in terms of the temperatures. And then if you look at the temperature extremes, remember there are three streams in each one, so this is the maximum that you got in each stream. Unharvested was 16.8 degrees Celsius, 16.2, a little cooler in the 7-year-old, same as the unharvested in this 14 to 17-year-old, and then about the same in a 5 to 6-year buffered one. So not much difference in the absolute maximum temperatures. And in this case, the summer maximum temperatures above the average of unharvested controls, 0.9 degrees in the 7-year-old, a little bit warmer in the 14 to 17, and the buffered one was actually the warmest, but it's not a dramatic increase. And that's just in one, the maximum in one stream, of course. So not a great difference in increase. And interestingly, the temperature in Waddell Creek is actually warmer than those in the small watersheds. So there seems to be some effect as you go downstream as the streams get larger in terms of the temperature. So 14.3 in the control and 15.6% in the, this is the unharvested in that Waddell Creek. And the same trend is in terms of the average daily maximum temperature. It's interesting to sort of see how temperature changes during the day in these streams. And this is actually one of the clear-cut streams, a 6-year-old one, and it's cooler than the other streams. And it drops down in temperature to its sort of a minimum about the middle of the day, and then it increases in temperature later on. So it's actually during the evening hours that it actually reaches its maximum temperature. All the other streams are basically hooked together. The same sort of a trend, but they're not very different in terms of the daily trend. This is another study that we did with a student, one of our students, Melissa Maxa, who looked at sediment in wood in these harvested buffered streams, either clear-cut or buffered, and found that there's a fair amount of wood, not coarse woody debris, but just wood, small diameter material that's left after the clear-cutting operation. And we think that this actually might be one of the reasons why some of these clear-cut streams are actually relatively cool. Temperature, however, does affect have some effect. This is the Olympia temperature, maximum temperatures in 2004 in July and August. And so it drops down to 2004 to 2005 and sort of levels off a bit in here. Some of the streams sort of show the same kind of a trend. Others, like this, the 7-year-old clear-cut one here, actually just sort of keep on going down. So although there's an effect of temperature, it isn't totally one-to-one relationship. This variable buffered stream that I mentioned, we did 1 year of monitoring beforehand, and then looked at the temperature after that. It did indeed go up about a little over 1 degree the year after harvesting, and then it dropped back down again in here. So typical response is that the temperature goes up a little bit after harvesting, but not very much. Now, the Forest Service and DNR and the Department of Ecology have looked at a number of other streams in the same area. They have a fixed-width buffer, clear-cut, patch clear-cutting, and control. And they actually monitored streams before they did the treatment, so they've got the pre-treatment temperatures and after-treatment temperatures, but found pretty similar things. It only increases a maximum of about 3 degrees in a clear cut, but even the fixed width buffer, it tends to go up as well. So what we found is sort of similar to what the other people found in this particular watershed, is that it doesn't go up a tremendous amount. And the other problem with the buffers is that it also tends to be difficult to get the trees to stand up. So they fall down fairly readily after the operation. And even though the stream biota, Pete Bisson actually provided this photograph and did some work looking at stream biota, found that in these continuous buffers, some of the biota, like the mayflies and caddisflies, actually were protected in these continuous buffers, and they went down in the clear cut, and some of the other invertebrates actually didn't change or actually had very little effect in terms of clear cutting. But you're not going to get a lot in terms of protection if the buffer actually doesn't stand up. So in terms of conclusions, there wasn't any statistical difference in maximum July and August stream temperatures with the various treatments, unharvested forest, clear cut, and buffered during that 2004 to 2006 period. We found a stream temperature of about 18.1 degrees C in the first year in that variably buffered stream. This isn't lethal for salamanders and fish, could be disruptive to physiology, I suppose. Maximum temperature in later years was 16.9 degrees in the buffer treatment, 5 to 6 years after harvesting. And generally, harvesting did not greatly increase the stream temperatures, maximum about 3 degrees in one stream. Stream temperatures were related to air temperatures, but not a one-to-one, and it wasn't consistent from among treatments from year to year. And stream temperatures and harvested streams seem to be responding to multiple factors like air temperature and shading and changing vegetation, wood in the channel, sediments and aspect, and are extremely variable from stream to stream. In fact, the highest temperatures were found in the northeast facing streams, which is not exactly what you would expect to see. And it seems to be related to the amount of wetlands on the site. And then stream temperatures have recovered 6 to 7 years after clear cut harvesting. Clear cuts were slightly cooler than the controls due to wood and shading. And stream buffers and headwater streams at this site don't seem to have a big influence on maximum stream temperatures. And they're very vulnerable to blowdown. And they could actually add sediments to streams by increasing the temperatures. So maybe, in terms of conclusion, maybe placing wood in the stream is actually, small wood in the stream may actually reduce stream temperatures. And maybe that's a management strategy that you could actually employ. So thank you. Well, the question was groundwater influence accounted for? And we actually didn't notice any groundwater in these streams, but I imagine that's got to be part of the equation. So it's difficult to actually predict these things with so many variables that are involved, and I'm sure groundwater is part of it.
Okay, if we opted the oxygen, so the kind of wood in the stream would decrease oxygen,
Potentially. The question was, if you add wood to the stream, it would reduce oxygen, and that could affect the biota. It could potentially do that, but this relatively slow decomposing material, and of course, natural litter in the stream would do the same kind of thing. So if you add some wood to the stream, and then, of course, the vegetation comes back pretty quickly over it to give some shading. So in these particular sites, it probably wouldn't affect the stream biota too much.
Right. The woody debris in streams, particularly from the buffering and the clear cutting down to the stream, would that have a huge effect on fish's ability to move around and use their habitat?
Well, it would if there were fish in these streams, but these, of course, are non-fish bearing streams, right? If you have big wood in the streams, it probably doesn't have as much of an impact as the small wood. But the size of the stream's only this big,
of course.
Right. So,
So it might affect the stream biota in some way, but it won't affect fish because there aren't any in these streams.
Yep. Do you have a handle on the percentages or the ratios of this channel wood between zone 1 and 2 wood that's within the wetted perimeter of the channel versus zone 3 and 4 wood, which is above and along the channel?
The question was how much wood is in the various zones in the stream in a way, and we know how much is in the stream itself and how much sediment was in this with other students, but we don't know exactly what's upslope from that. So,
way back.
Dan, you mentioned the risk with having buffers that you get additional windrow and potentially more sediment. Have you looked at other studies and because the conventional wisdom is buffers protect?
Yeah, I know. The conventional wisdom is that buffers protect, and of course, blowdown could add more sediment. And this student, Melissa Maxa, that we had working on this, did find that there actually was some more sediment as a result of being in the buffers with respect to blowdown. Not a huge amount more, but that's something we want to actually investigate, trying to find out what the effects of this blowdown really is. We don't have a really good handle on it. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Bob.